I think, yeah, this, maybe this morning I'll talk about one of the subjects which is always comes up in the meditation retreat, which is like mindfulness. And the reason I good idea to bring it up at this stage is that there's many theories and ideas of what mindfulness is, and it can be very confusing. But it's such an important quality to incorporate into one's meditation practice. If one doesn't understand it correctly, you can be wasting a lot of time. And because it's put as a central feature of many types of meditation, sometimes people think Ajahn Brahm doesn't teach mindfulness. But I'm going to really explain mindfulness in great detail and in areas of mindfulness which you may not have imagined before, to expand and deepen one's appreciation of that term and how it fits in to the whole path of meditation. Because sometimes people get confused about the difference between mindfulness and samadhi. And what's the difference between those two? And actually, what is mindfulness and how should one practice it? Certainly when I started meditating, people told me to be mindful. I said, what do you mean? They just be mindful. Well, what is mindfulness? Just be mindful. It didn't really help very much when people wouldn't give you a straight answer to what mindfulness truly was. They just be aware. What do you mean? How to be aware? Aren't we already aware? Surely the only people who aren't mindful are the ones who are either asleep or dead. Everyone else is aware of something or other. And so what is actually the big deal about this mindfulness business? And it took a lot of probably practice, reading, suttas, reflection, experience, to really understand what this mindfulness business is all about. First of all, the thing you could say is that there's no such thing as mindfulness, except when it's mindful of something. The mindfulness is always directed. It must always be put onto a certain aspect of existence. Otherwise you can't really say that you're being really mindful. It's just awareness of ordinary human beings. Everyone is mindful in that sense, they're aware of something. But here that the awareness is directed onto a certain area. So that's the first thing to know about mindfulness. It carries with it the instruction of directing it somewhere. It also carries with it other instructions. I think many of you have heard before, the simile of the gatekeeper. And that was also something which the Buddha said to describe mindfulness. He gave a simile of the gatekeeper to really illustrate what mindfulness truly is. Because by using metaphors and similes from real life, you can get a real deep understanding of what these terms are all about. And in that simile of the gatekeeper, that really opened up a lot of understanding about what mindfulness is and how it's connected to other things. Because in that simile of the gatekeeper is there to stand guard over a city and only let the friends, the good people in, and to keep out the terrorists, the enemies and other people who could very easily come and infiltrate the city and take it over. And many of you have heard that how I've adapted that simile to modern times, about a person who is a very wealthy person and has a gatekeeper, a guard on their house when they're off on the retreat. And always telling that gatekeeper, be careful because there are burglars around. And I'm going away for 9 days and I want you to make sure that sort of you're mindful. I'm not really saying mindful of what. And so you go on a retreat. When you go home, you find your house has been burgled. I love this story. Your house has been burgled, and so you go and tell off the gatekeeper, I told you to be mindful. And what does the gatekeeper say? You know the punchline, I was mindful. I saw the thieves going in, I noted going in, going in, going in. I saw them coming out again, I noted going out, going out, going out. I saw them taking DVD, DVD, DVD. I saw them taking jewellery, jewellery, jewellery. I noted banknotes, banknotes, banknotes. I noted safe, 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 being carried out of the car. I was very mindful all the time. Noting being mindful. Now, I know that's a bit cheeky of other traditions, but it's true, isn't it? Would you be happy with a gatekeeper like that? Is a gatekeeper doing their job? And of course the answer is no, they're not. Because mindfulness, it's not just knowing, it's not just noting, it's not just being aware, it carries with it responsibilities as well. This is why in Buddhism the word mindfulness is also the word for memory as well. It's recording the instructions. And that is perhaps the one part of mindfulness which people forget too often. It's mindful of what you're supposed to be doing. Not just of what you're doing, but also what you're supposed to be doing. Of the instructions. The two actually go very close together. So similarly the gatekeeper, tell the gatekeeper, if you see any thieves trying to break into the house, stop them. If you see thieves already in the house, because the thieves can be very sneaky, they can go around the back way over the wall and into the house, if you see them in the house, then call the police to eject them. And of course, one of the best ways of keeping the thieves out of your house is to have all your best friends in your house. If you're away for 9 days, then invite your friends and mates, please. Enjoy the facilities of my house, because we've got good people in the house, and the thieves and bandits see that the house is occupied, they'll always go somewhere else. So the job of the gatekeeper number three is to invite all your friends. If you see them passing by, invite them in. And the fourth instruction to the gatekeeper is if the friends are in the house, keep them up in there as long as possible. Give them the key to the refrigerator. And tell them so to help themselves to whatever they like. Tell them to enjoy the facilities of the house. Keep them in there as long as possible. Entertain them. And encourage them to stay. That's the fourth instruction to the gatekeeper. And for those of you who've heard the story before, or if you haven't heard the story but you know the Buddha's four right efforts, then you can actually see that I've just explained in a nice simile what the Buddha's four right efforts are. And how they're connected with mindfulness. Because in Buddhism, the first right effort is to keep unskillful and unwholesome dhammas out of your mind. Because they rob you of happiness, they rob you of peace, they rob you of the opportunity for enlightenment. Just as thieves can rob your house of all your possessions. It's so easy, isn't it? We can get into some nice states of meditation, have a lovely time, we can lose it so easily. By allowing the thieves, the unwholesome dhammas, to enter our mind. So the third job of mindfulness is to keep the unwholesome stuff out of the mind. What is the unwholesome stuff? What are the thieves? Time is a great thief. Perceptions of the past and the future. Doesn't that steal your presence of mind? Doesn't that steal the wonderful freedom of now? When you allow thoughts of the future, what we could have for lunch. Who ate too much toast this morning for breakfast? That's all gone. Don't allow the past or the future to actually to steal the present moment. That is an unwholesome dhamma in this meditation. Thoughts, you can be so nice and still and peaceful, and you start thinking, I wonder what my son is doing this weekend. There we go. Now, once you start thinking that, it goes on and on and on and on. I wonder what my husband's up to. He seemed to be so encouraging for me to go on this retreat this weekend. That's suspicious. You see how you can sort of thoughts can get in the mind and keep on going, and they start churning more thoughts. You've allowed the thief to steal your silence. Sometimes you're watching the breath, so lovely and peaceful. And someone else, someone next to you, gets up and goes out. Stupid people, can't they know that they're supposed to be silent? They're like elephants, they're not like sort of meditators. Maybe I should put a question for Ajahn Bhak. Can everyone be really quiet when they get up and go down? And then you've allowed sort of something else, the person next to you, to steal your awareness of breath. Understand what the robbers are? When you get into the beautiful nimittas, they are just so precious. So valuable, so rare, that many thieves would love to get their hands on those. That's why you have to be very, very mindful not to allow anything to steal those beautiful nimittas. It's all like fear and excitement. Those are the enemies of the nimittas. Shh. No control, be quiet, be still. And that's actually the thieves of the space of meditation. So you know what those thieves are. Mindfulness. Like the gatekeeper of a great city has to be very sharp, has to have the most wanted list. Just like you have the most wanted list Who's your meditation enemy, number one? So mindfulness has this big wantedness. Sometimes you have the pictures, sloth and torpor. Or you've got this picture of anger, ill will, or desire. Whatever it is, you have these pictures of the most wanted list in your gatekeeper's hut. So you just know exactly what you've got to watch out for. That's important for mindfulness, you know, to have them, so that the gatekeeper, when people come into the city, into your mind, you can recognize, is this a friend or is this an enemy? Is this going to be conducive to more meditation, more peace, more stillness? Or is this going to stop me getting success in meditation? So many gatekeepers put happiness as public enemy number one. And that's a great friend. You get a little bit of happiness coming in, or you'll be attached, get out. And that's such a shame. So please, at least your gatekeeper mindfulness, please know that happiness is public friend number one. The great friend of meditation. So if you see a little bit of happiness coming into your house, into your city, come in. Oh, thank you for coming. Welcome them. More happiness, even bliss. Welcome it, come on. Bring all your friends, more happiness. Come on, more bliss. Come on, more bliss. You're actually inviting in the friends of meditation, because this is not the pleasure of the senses. This is the happiness born of letting go. These are the good friends. There's other types of pleasures which are the enemies, you know, like fantasies, sex or sort of fantasies, or dreams about food, or other stuff which you can allow in your mind. So as a gatekeeper, just know who the enemies are and who the friends are. And if you see the enemies about to come in, you've got to stop them. Say no. It's easy if you can recognize your enemies. You recognize them, you know them very well. It's very easy to stop them. Just in that simile of the snake the other day. If you know exactly what your enemy is, you're very alert, you'd always avoid it. But sometimes, as meditators, we don't know our enemies from our friends. We don't know our friends from our enemies. And we think, you know, we're getting nice and sleepy and think, oh, this is so nice. But sometimes it's an enemy. Or we get ill will. You know, there's a lot of pleasure to be got from anger. If there wasn't, the Buddha said, you wouldn't ever get angry. You know, you feel alive, you feel awake, especially early in the morning. Sort of when you first get up. Try getting angry at somebody. You feel, oh, you know, like Mr. Bush, you know, all these weapons of mass destruction on Iraq, he can't do this. You feel alive and alert, don't you? You feel awake. People really can get off on anger, which is why they get angry. There's a certain pleasure to it. And that's why it's very easy to allow ourselves just to get angry at the person sitting next to us, or the person who was just slurping their food at breakfast, and they do it every day. Whatever it is. So you're allowing yourself. Why do you allow yourself to do this? Because there's a certain amount of pressure in it. So be careful, because many enemies masquerade as friends. Many friends are mistaken to be enemies. So the wisdom in our meditation knows those states which are our friends. This is the wisdom aspect of mindfulness. And this is a lot of experience is needed to know the difference between a friend and an enemy in meditation. You may be sitting for a long period of time and the thought comes up, oh, it's about time to move. It's very hard to know whether that's an enemy or a friend. Whether that's actually you should be sitting longer or it is really the time to move. And that takes a lot of experience and wisdom to know whether to follow that or whether to let it go. Sometimes you get the feeling in the meditation, you've got an ache in the body. Should I change my posture? Or should I scratch that itch? What should I do? Is that an enemy or a friend? Should I allow that in or should I just disregard it? It takes a lot of wisdom actually to know what really is a disturbance which should be attended to and what should just be let go of and will just disappear all by itself. As a technique which can be used in the meantime until you get so much skill and experience in meditation, you can just know immediately what disturbance should be attended to and what should be just thrown away. Is whenever there's a disturbance in the meditation, then ignore it the first time it comes up. It might be like an ache in the body, a pain somewhere. Ignore it. If it comes up again, disturbs your focus of attention, ignore it a second time, ignore it three times. And then if it comes up again, this ache, and you can't sort of go back to your breath or whatever else you're watching, then go to that feeling, go to that pain, go to that itch, and make that the object of your meditation for a while. So you're not watching the breath, you're watching the pain, you're watching the ache, you're watching the itch. And if it, as you're watching that sort of that pain, that itch, that disturbance, if the thought comes up, the intention arises, I should scratch this itch, or I should move my legs, or I should do something, ignore that command the first time. If it comes up a second time, ignore it a second time, ignore it three times. Don't scratch the itch, or don't move the legs. If it comes up a third time, I really have to move, I really have to scratch this. The fourth time, scratch it, move it. And that's a very skillful means for the time being. Because what that does, it means that you ignore the problem three times before you go to it. Then you take the problem as your meditation object. And when the mind says do something about it, for three times you do nothing. And the fourth time, then you do something. It shows a little bit of restraint, a little bit of endurance. It gives you time to investigate whether these things really need your input or whether you can just leave them alone and go back to your meditation object. And little by little you learn from that technique about how, what actually things are your enemies and what are your friends in meditation. And when you know what your enemies are, what your friends are, what the thieves are, what your friends are, if you see the thieves outside the house trying to get in, you stop them. Say no. It's very easy to do that once you recognize these things. You see them like lingering around, about to come up. Ill will and hatred is very easy to catch and to stop. If you see it coming, you see yourself getting a little bit irritated and you think, I'm not going to buy into that. And you stop it. If you stop it early, it's very easy to prevent. Literally, because anger is just like a small plant. If you can catch it when it's just growing, you can just pull it out with your two fingers. But if you allow it to grow into a huge tree, you need chainsaws and bulldozers and backhoes to dig out the roots to get it out. You've left it too long. Anger is like that. You catch it early, it's just so easy to deal with. You catch it too late, it's this huge thing which is so difficult to manage. So the good gatekeeper sees these things coming. Any hindrance, any difficulty in meditation, sees it coming and keeps it out. And if it sees that these things have actually got into the mind somehow or other, you have wandered off, the gatekeeper knows how to get rid of these things. How to call the police. But you've got to be very careful with these thieves and robbers. If you are too violent to them, you might keep them out of the house, but they call their friends and they come back again. So you have to be very gentle in kicking out the unwholesome states of the mind from the mind. Sometimes kicking them out makes it worse. You may have wandered off, say, get out of here, wandering mind. I shouldn't be wandering. Get out. Come on, back to the breath. Come on, back to the breath. You get so tense. It's even worse. You're not actually kicking out the unwholesome dhammas in a wise way. So if you can, just do this with Buddhist gentleness. And you don't leave any enemies in the house. And the enemies don't come back again. But of course, in that simile of the gatekeeper, the best way of avoiding unwholesome states coming into your mind is having lots of wholesome states in your mind. The best way of avoiding thieves and burglars in your house is having lots of really nice good friends. Heaps of them who stay a long time. That's the third and fourth line effort to invite wholesome states in the mind and maintain them. Encourage them. Keep them going. So you invite like wholesome states. Who are your friends? Loving kindness is your friend. Stillness is your friend. With peace, letting go is your friend. Allow all these wonderful friends into your house. Like kindness, peace, stillness. The breath is a great friend. Allow the breath to come into your house. So it fills the mind up so no unwholesome dhammas can come in at all. And the best of the friends, I've already mentioned, public friend number one is? Happiness, yeah. Invite happiness into your mind. If you've got happiness into the mind, you can't get angry. You can't really have sensory desire. You can't even have sloth and torpor. If you're happy and have a lovely meditation, you can hardly sleep at night. That's why happiness is such a huge friend. So if you get happiness in your mind, even a little bit starts to come in, please entertain it. Please give it, the key to the refrigerator. Let it in there. Give it as much happiness, as much support, as much pleasure, as much kindness as you possibly can. Invite it in. And maintain it. Entertain it. Then happiness stays a long time. And if you're happy in your meditation, in the retreat, then you're sweet. Meditation goes so lovely and everything goes fine. So this is actually mindfulness inviting in and maintaining those wholesome qualities like happiness and keeping them there for a long time. Sometimes it happens, we do get nice peaceful meditations. We do get happy, we do get still. And what do? Wow, this is really great. And we just throw it away immediately. Whenever you do have lovely meditations, these are very valuable. Please look after them. It's like you've been given a very valuable jewel. A priceless jewel. So carry it very carefully lest you lose it. When you get a lovely meditation, just walk very carefully from your meditation posture to where you do your walking. Or walk very carefully to the dining room for your breakfast or for your lunch. Or walk very carefully to your room to go to sleep at night. As if you're guarding something very, very precious. And the peace, the happiness, the clarity, the freedom which you've built up in your meditation. Too often the people throw away the successes in the meditation on the way to the walking path. Or they throw away what they've gained on the walking path on the way to their sitting cushion. They haven't looked after these wonderful qualities of mind. That's the job of mindfulness, to guard your mind and to keep in those very, very beautiful good qualities, your friends. So you see that mindfulness has a job to do. It has to know the friend from the enemy and has to keep out the enemies and cultivate the friends so that unwholesome states don't arise in the mind. And we understand that mindfulness has this job to do. Sometimes people might argue, oh, that's just controlling again. It's not controlling, it's again letting go. And mindfulness does the job of letting go, because that's the wholesome qualities. Letting go is not being heedless. Letting go takes mindfulness. Letting go takes that effort. It takes wisdom. It takes the effort put into mindfulness to guard against controlling and doing. That's where the effort goes. It takes a while to actually to stop doing things. It takes that carefulness, that knowing what we actually really mean by controlling and letting go. And as we do this, we get deeper and deeper into meditation. And as we get deeper and deeper into meditation, we get these states of what I call like power mindfulness. And I mentioned one the other night when I was saying about looking at the carpet, and the carpet looks just so beautiful, so wonderful. Or you go and look at a flower on a tree and it looks the most beautiful flower you've ever seen in your whole life. When these things start to happen to you, and you investigate these things, then you really start to find out what mindfulness can truly be. Because mindfulness, again, is remembering the instruction, but it's a quality of awareness, alertness. And it surprises you, even shocks you, to see that in ordinary life we think we're alert, we think we're aware, but we're only running on one cylinder, as the simile goes. We're not really mindful at all, we're as dull as anything. Because our mind's got no power, no strength. It's been worn out. It's just like a computer screen which needs replacing, because the energies are almost gone, it's just so dull. And this is actually our mind. And what happens in meditation retreats like this, we're putting all the energy into mindfulness again, so we're getting more and more alert, more and more bright, more and more happy. We get more power in our mind. And we get these things called superpower mindfulness. And you realize just how impossible it is to really actually to see reality when you've got this ordinary mind which hasn't been empowered by samadhi. The job of samadhi is to empower mindfulness, to give it strength, to give it energy, to give it power. And you actually see this when you're meditating. The ordinary meditations you have, you know, in Naramara at home or wherever, you know, they're sort of okay. You seem to be aware. But then you get states of heightened awareness, where whatever you see, whatever you look at, whatever you investigate, you can do with so much ease and so much power. You've got penetration with your mind. And you ask, where is that coming from? That is coming from so the practice of samadhi. What samadhi is the ability, the result of samadhi, is the ability to sustain that mindfulness on one thing. And in particular, sustain it on just knowing, taking it away from doing. With all that energy, you can really see, you can hear, you can know in greater and greater and greater depths. So mindfulness has also got its different levels of intensity. And here in the practice of mindfulness, we actually build up the intensity of mindfulness. It's like we put more and more batteries into a flashlight. We turn up the voltage until it gets brighter and brighter and brighter, until sometimes you think it's going to burn you, or it's going to sort of blow the bulb, but it doesn't. It just keeps on getting brighter and brighter and brighter. And the more brightness there is in the room, the more detail you see. And when we were sitting here this morning, when the lights were out, you could only see silhouettes of people. Now, when you've got the lights on and the sun is up, you can see more details. If you've got like a flashlight, or even like, you know, one of these big spotlights, you can see all your pimples. That's why that a year or two ago, when I had to go and do an interview on TV, I had to go into the makeup room first of all. Because under the spotlights, that was very embarrassing. The first time as a monk, I had to go and get makeup. And the worst thing there was that a couple of monks were watching at the time. They were giggling. But why do you have to get made up when you go in front of the spotlights? Actually, on that TV, I should have asked afterwards, can you actually refuse? I say you can refuse, because this was in Channel 9 in Perth. There's two people who have actually refused having being made up. And one was, I think, Liam Gallagher of Oasis, when he was in Perth some years ago. He actually refused to be made up for TV. And they didn't argue with him, because he, you know, punches people. And the other one, interesting, he refused to be made up, was Rolf Harris. He's got so much hair, he doesn't really matter. And I missed my opportunity, I could have been number three. But nevertheless, why do you actually have to be made up on television? Because under such intense spotlights, you can see all of the faults in your face, or the pimples, or whatever else, which you're not supposed to see. That's what mindfulness does. It sees the truth of things. In mindfulness, even the most beautiful woman is ugly. It's true. Even in mindfulness, the most delicious food is yuck. That's why a lot of times we don't want to be mindful, because it blows all our fantasies to pieces. But when you really get strong mindfulness, you start to see these things. And with that really, really, really strong mindfulness, you see into the nature of things. Because you've got the full light on the picture. So when we're talking about mindfulness, it's not ordinary mindfulness. Basically, if you haven't got samadhi, you're wasting your time trying to be mindful and getting to understand things. I know that's a hard thing to say, but it's true. You just haven't got the power to see deeply into things. All you see is what you want to see. All you see is what you expect to see, what you've been taught to see. Just fulfilling your conditioning, that's all. But with superpower mindfulness, when the mind is that bright, you can look at a carpet and, wow, look at that. Wow, look at that. Wow, that's an amazing brick on that wall over there. You've seen all the colours in it and its shape. With superpower mindfulness like that, whatever you look at, you can't help but seeing the truth. Even when it's shocking, surprising, not what you expect. That's what happens with this mindfulness. So the job of our meditation retreat is to build up mindfulness. Build it up by putting on one thing, just the knowing, taking away from the doing, till it gets stronger and stronger and stronger, more and more bright. As it gets brighter and brighter and stronger, you understand this, it has to be focused on a small area of the world. The smaller area of the world is focused on, the more power it builds up. The more it's taken away from doing and into non-doing, into what's called imperturbability, this non-moving, absolute stillness, the more power it has. Mindfulness reaches its peak of strength in what's called the fourth jhana. That's the purity of mindfulness built on equanimity. It's a state of imperturbability. The mindfulness is so strong, so focused, so powerful, that that's the peak of mindfulness for a human being, or for any being for that matter. And that's why, if you read the suttas, that's what you will find. So sometimes when we do a meditation retreat like this, people think this is not insight. This is actually the way to insight. This is Ajahn Brahm's Vipassana retreat. Through empowering mindfulness, not ordinary mindfulness, but to its real peak. If you want to really see things the way they truly are, you can't use ordinary mindfulness. That is ordinary. Anyone can do that. How many people do you know who are enlightened? You need something special to be able to see things as they truly are. And that's that superpower mindfulness. It just happens to be a wonderful accessory of the path, a byproduct of the path. The superpower of mindfulness is also very blissful and very much fun to do. It's ecstatic. And this is why people get into superpower mindfulness, just because of the sheer fun of it. You do it for bliss. But the byproduct, or really the main product, the bliss is the byproduct, the main product is it just empowers the mind so much that the mindfulness becomes superpowered. And with such superpowered mindfulness, it can also be directed and sustained on its object. Because for mindfulness to do its job, it also has to be focused and kept on that focus long enough to do its job. And again, one of the other reasons why mindfulness doesn't do its job, it may be strong, but it doesn't stay put. It's wandering from place to place. This is why when you look at a carpet and it opens up, you've got to keep your attention on it. Wow! And it opens up slowly and gently until it really starts to open up to you. And then, because of the bliss of it, you can sustain your attention on that very easy. This is the other job of mindfulness, to be able to sustain its attention on the important parts of the world. The part which will give you true understanding and true wisdom. And when it's sustained on those things, you can really see what's going on. So we start with sustaining our attention on things like the present moment, on silence. What is silence? Do you know what silence is? Put silence in front of your mind. Allow mindfulness just to stay with silence. And then you'll find out what silence truly is. You can't think silence. You can only know silence. When you're watching the breath, do you really know what your breath is? Breathe in and out all your life, but do you really know what it is? Put the breath in front of mindfulness, especially when it becomes superpowered. Wow, this is amazing, this breath coming in and going out. Like the carpet or the flower, the breath opens out to you. You see it in its great beauty. What is the mind? Have all of these psychologists and scientists having all these theories about what the mind is, whether there is such a thing as a mind or not. To hell with all of those stupid people. You just go and watch your own mind. Put it in front of you. And the nimitta comes up. With superpower mindfulness, you're seeing the mind which is closest to you, your mind. And you look at it for long periods of time. Then you understand what this word mind is, what citta is. You see what the Buddha saw, how he understood his citta, his mind. But you have to keep your attention there to be able to fully investigate and understand what's going on. The knower. Who is this thing which knows, which hears, which sees, which receives the input of the world, the sensitive being, or is it a being? We put that in front of this superpower mindfulness. See what it is. Who were you in a past life? You put past lives in front of superpower mindfulness. Mind, what was your earliest memory? With superpower mindfulness, it goes back and finds that memory for you. This is where you get into the fun stuff of a meditation retreat. Not just the working with sloth and torpor and lurking with the wandering mind and thinking. That's really boring stuff, isn't it? You do that every retreat. How about doing something different this retreat? Past lives. Why not? Get in there and do these things. So we have to build up superpower mindfulness to do these things. In your meditation, when you get stuck, power mindfulness. Focus your attention there. What is going on? And sustain that attention. Don't allow it to move. Keep on that point of where you're getting stuck until you see what your attachment is, what the problem is. And then you overcome it. You see through it. And you just don't just see through it once. By seeing through it there, you'll be able to see through it again. You've broken through one of your key attachments. You've untied it. It will tie up again, but you've weakened it. And you weaken it again and again and again and again and again till you break through forever that bond. And you go deeper in your meditation. The deeper you go in your meditation shows you the weaker your attachments are. When you get into deep meditation, that shows you haven't got many attachments left at all. They may not be fully overcome, but they, my goodness, they've been weakened. Keep on going, and you'll weaken them until they disappear. This is what happens. So we sustain our awareness, our mindfulness on these things, until we break through, until we see. So that's what mindfulness actually is. So to sum up again, we've got the different levels of mindfulness, which we should recognize, and part of this retreat is to actually to experience what I mean by the different levels of mindfulness, ordinary mindfulness. Already you had a heightened mindfulness when you were out there in the world. Perhaps you don't realize it because the mindfulness has increased incrementally. But if you just stepped outside onto that street, then you'd realize just how your mindfulness has changed over the last 2 or 3 days. When you really get it going, very strong. You might see some people just standing out there in the garden, just looking completely zonked out of their mind, like little zombies, just staring at a leaf, with a big smile on their face. Mm-hmm. That's someone who's just doing superpower mindfulness. Wow. It's lovely to see people like that. I really get off on that. It's so sweet when they first get into superpower mindfulness. Big bright eyes, silly smile on their face. And they were so happy. Some years ago at a retreat in Melbourne, this Thai lady I've known for such a long time, she'd been trying so hard to do some meditation. And like everyone else, never getting anywhere, having all sorts of problems and difficulties, wandering mind, back pains. But she'd done so much like Dana in the past, so much generosity, that she deserved something. And this one retreat, she got something. And just after the Bindabhata, after, you know, going for the food, she was waiting me on the way back, sitting by the side of the path, with her hands up like this, and staring at me with these, like these, almost like it reminded me like the eyes of someone who's just fallen in love. Not with me, but with meditation. And she said, "Ajahn Bhav, I've done it." It was so sweet, so nice. So it's lovely when those sort of things happen, and they happen to just ordinary people. So this is actually superpower mindfulness, which is coming up. And she got one of her first tastes of that. And just everything is just so bright and wonderful. Lots of happiness, lots of power. Then whatever you look at, then you can really see it deeply. And as you know, in these meditation retreats, you get some superpower mindfulness coming up. Lots of energy, and you can tell it by, you know, those leaves on the tree. Someone's been polishing them with brasso or something. Or somebody's been doing something to this carpet, or someone's, you know, children's been putting some illegal substances into the food or something. I'm not quite sure what's been happening, but wow, look at this. When that happens to you, first of all, enjoy it. Investigate it. None of that superpower mindfulness. The ability of the mind is just being up several thousand poles. And then just go and play around with that. Enjoy this look of a tree, but also maybe just ask yourself, what is my earliest memory business? It's called mindfulness of past lives. Try it, see what happens. It's really good fun. All you need to do is just one little suggestion, because mindfulness, when it's superpowered, is incredibly obedient. You know that I've been saying about instructing your gatekeeper or instructing the taxi driver. It's the same symbol. You're instructing mindfulness, telling her what to do. You tell mindfulness just go and watch the breath. A lot of times it will do it, but sometimes it doesn't because it's very weak. But you get superpower mindfulness and you say, okay, mindfulness, just watch the breath. It will do it just as the most obedient slave you've ever had. You just tell that mindfulness, go and get me an early memory, please. And it'd be like this well-trained doggy who just trots off, goes and gets an early memory, trots back, and here you are, master. Now I want another one. Trots off, goes and gets something earlier, here you are, master. It's wonderful when my mindfulness is well-trained like this. It does all these wonderful things for you. Unless it actually gets the fun and power of meditation. So when we talk about mindfulness, it's huge mindfulness, it's ordinary mindfulness. And this is actually what we do. With also mindfulness, that the other thing which I'm going to bring up now, this is back to ordinary mindfulness, I'm afraid, that when we're just even meditating, you can always give instructions to the mind. This is again working with mindfulness. It may not be as obedient as it should be, but at least it's reasonably obedient. The same way that you tell yourself your snake, the thing you've really got to be alert to, the thing you've really got to keep your guard against, your worst hindrance, wandering minds, thought and torpor, ill will, or sensory desire, whatever, you can always program your mind. Programming your mind is called instructing mindfulness. When you instruct mindfulness, you give it clear orders. You say, okay mind, watch the breath. And you talk to your mind. The mind says, what do you mean watch the breath? Mind, that which tells you whether you're breathing in or breathing out. Okay? That's what I want you to watch. Make it very clear, precise, and single. Don't give too many instructions at the same time. The mind will get confused. And you'll be surprised as how the mind will be obedient or watch the breath for you. You give it time. This is why it's very useful at the beginning of every meditation to program your mind. To set the parameters, what you're trying to do, what this is really all about, and the dangers, or the one danger you really want to look out for. Because your mind is going to go on the journey of meditation for you. If it hasn't got clear instructions, if it doesn't know what it's supposed to do, of course it will waste time, it will wander around all over the place. Why does a mind wander around? Because it hasn't been given a direction. So give it a clear direction. Don't interrupt and confuse it with other directions throughout the meditation, changing this, giving orders all the time, like the taxi driver simile. Give it a clear instructions and let it get on with the business. You have to be patient, it takes time. It's amazing just how it will cooperate. If you're very clear in your instructions, and also you listen very clearly to those instructions, so they really go in. So as we do this, we find actually we can program the mind. We can program mindfulness. We can give instructions, and the mind remembers those instructions. That's another important part of mindfulness. Giving instructions to the mind, so the mind remembers them clearly. And then it does the job. It's marvellous to watch this in your meditation, because you're going along, the problem comes up, and even before you consciously understand the problem and you start to verbalize a response to the problem, the mind does it. Sometimes you get into these blockages in your meditation and I'm about to sort of do something, but the mind already does it before I can even think about it. And you always get the experience, who did that? Now remember, okay, mine did that because I told it to earlier. Or other times, I didn't tell it to do that. If you told that, I remember, Hey, Ajahn Chah taught me to do that. Ajahn Chah programmed me. And then so you get to that little stage, and some teaching of Ajahn Chah years and years ago is remembered by the mind. The mind knows what to do. And you get through that blockage. Incredible just the way that we get programmed by a good teacher. So that when you get to these stages, be quiet, let go, don't do anything. I've already given that little program. What happens? You get into a nice meditation, and then something, what should I do? And then that idea will come up. Be quiet, don't do anything. And then you go deeper. The mind remembers those programs. And this is actually how we get into these deep meditations. We program the mind exactly what to do. That is also part of mindfulness, remembering the instructions. That became very clear when I remember one of the stories from the Digha Nikaya of the Lady Gopika. This is again another favourite story of mine because it was about two naughty monks. And this Lady Gopika, she was one of these devout Buddhists who would always go around cooking and cleaning for these monks. And these two monks came to spend the rain retreat by her village. And so she invited them, she helped make sure there was like proper huts for them. And her and her alone gave food every day to these monks and helped them with little duties so they could be free to meditate. And she really wanted them to sort of do well in their meditation. So she's doing her own business for her family, for her husband, her own duties in the fields, and at the same time, all her spare time she was doing, looking after these monks. Because she was a faithful Buddhist and she wanted them to do well. And when she died, she got reborn in the Tara Tingsa realm, which is one of the heaven realms. And these two monks, when she actually was up there, she found these two monks had got reborn a couple of levels lower than her. And she got really fed up about this. So she went round to sort of scold them. She went down to this heaven and said, "You two monks, I've been cleaning, washing, cooking for you guys. And what have you been doing? You probably must have been sleeping all that rain retreat, doing nothing at all, you lazy, no good for nothing monks." Because she got much higher. And as she scolded these two monks for being lazy, she'd worked for them so hard. That one of them, this is actually what the test said, one of them roused mindfulness. And from there, died from that place and got reborn in the realm of non-returners. While the other one just dismissed her and told her to basically get lost. And he remained in that state. And the interesting point was just the way that he aroused mindfulness. What did that actually mean? It didn't mean he was just saying, "Oh, scolding, scolding, scolding." It also means he remembered all those teachings of the Buddha. He remembered the Dhamma. He recalled the instructions. And that state, recalling his instructions, was enough for him to see that Dhamma and to completely let go of sensory desires and get reborn in another state. That's also mindfulness. Remembering all these teachings at the right time and the right place. That's what mindfulness truly means. So it's not just alertness, it's not just superpower mindfulness. It also carries with it this knowing of the instructions, the framework of the Dhamma. So what you see, what you're aware of, what you know in full mindfulness, you also understand its significance. That's what real mindfulness is. So that's a little talk today on mindfulness. Much more than you thought. Different levels of mindfulness, not just knowing, but also knowing the instructions, knowing the Dhamma. Effort as well as part of mindfulness. To abandon unwholesome states, to keep up good states. And that's the best thing about that simile. Good states, the more good states you have, is the best way of overcoming the evil states. Have lots of happiness, lots of bliss, lots of peace, and then you can't get unhappy, you can't get sort of ill will, you can't get grumpiness. Because you just blissed out. So that's a little talk today on mindfulness. Any questions? 1, 2. Yeah?
And then you talk about making a determination subject towards prayer. Can you pair particular flavour, emotional flavour, with the prayer? you know, I'm going to watch the breath of anger, I'm going to watch the breath of softness and compassion, I'm going to watch the breath of courage or something like that. In other words, you're getting the actual physical thing that you're saying to anchor on and marrying it with an emotional feeling and use determination or determinations to make that joining and string it on.
Yeah, you can actually join up an emotion with, say, the breath, and tell mindfulness when you're watching the breath, watch it with joy or watch it with energy. But be careful not to give too many complicated instructions. Don't say, I've got to watch it with energy, this type of energy, not that type of energy. Maybe a bit of loving kindness as well, but also a bit of wisdom. I must also remember the fourth noble truth. Because that's the nature of, like, you know, human beings, especially Westerners, to complicate it. Now, did you remember everything I just said? It's just too much. So poor mindfulness just sort of blows a fuse. It can't remember it all. So if you want to give instructions to the mind, program the mind, it has to be simple and clear. Too complex, it just gets confused. Sort of too sort of woolly, and doesn't, what do you mean by that? Just imagine that you were being instructed by your boss to do a task. How would you like to be instructed? Really clear, so you know exactly what he means. And just nice and simple. Straightforward. And that's how to give instructions to someone working for you. That's also how to give instructions to your mind. Don't make it too complex. But yeah, you can actually make it, don't you need to make it absolutely simple. But enough so the mind knows exactly what it needs to do. Make sense? Yeah. It's just like, you know, having lunch. We have lunch, but you know, after a while, lunch is gone. So, you know, you're not going to have lunch at all because you can only have it for 5 or 10 minutes, and then it's not eating anymore. It's part of life, is actually to realise that the things which we have are subject to rise and fall, are impermanent, beyond our control. But still, a little bit of happiness is worth a lot, and the happiness which you get here in a meditation retreat. It's cumulative. You don't really lose it. Because the inclination stays. The next time you come on a meditation retreat, it comes much easier and much sooner. Just like in any other business. Just the longer you work there, the fatter your paycheck is. And the more often it comes. In other parts of the business, you do get retrenched, but not in Buddhism. So meditation just gets better and better and better. So yeah, sure, you get into lovely states of mind. Don't deny those states of mind because they're going to pass away. In fact, the more you do them, the less likely they are to pass away. And they pass away for short amounts of time. And they're very easy to get back again. But they're impossible to get if you don't see them at all. So sure, they'll pass away. But they'll come back again. Because the more the mind inclines to those places, the more it becomes used and familiar to those places. The more wise it becomes in the ways of meditation, the easier it is to get back there. So don't give up the opportunity to enjoy this 9-day retreat, knowing that sort of on the 10th day will be over. It's never really over, there's always another retreat coming next. Okay, just one turn into this year.
Continue that and sustain that, and also when you go to bed, it's still when you sleep, you lost it.
Well, actually, what you can do to allow yourself to sustain the good qualities which you build up on the sitting posture, on the walking path, is actually use visualizations. Imagine it's a beautiful flower which you've just grown, or a wonderful precious jewel which someone's just given you. And when you actually give it value by imagination, then you can imagine yourself carrying this beautiful flower back to your room with you. And you lay it next to your bed. You don't lay it on your bed where you crush it. You put it just to the side so it's there for you in the morning. And then you put it by the bedside and you say goodnight to it. You close your eyes. And when you wake up in the morning, it's there for you. So these are little exercises which you can do to maintain the beautiful qualities. You have a beautiful jewel. Now you take it into your room and put it very close to you. Maybe even put it close to your heart. And then go to sleep, feeling that jewel next to your heart, the jewel of loving kindness, the jewel of peace, the jewel of mindfulness. And you're caring for it, you're valuing it. If you do that after a sitting meditation, you find that it's like you've got a jewel on the top of your head. You get up very carefully so it doesn't fall off. And you walk very carefully, because you're protecting something very valuable. So valuing these qualities, and then finding just little ways of putting an emotion, a quality in the mind, giving it a more concrete form by using imagination, I think will help for you to be able to guard and protect it. So you don't have to start from scratch the following morning. So don't throw these things away. These aren't rubbish to be thrown in the rubbish bin. These are things to be protected and guarded. It's a very, very precious jewel. Pardon me? Sometimes these generalizations you just stay for effect. It's good rhetoric, it makes people laugh. But it's not absolutely a waste of time, obviously. It's very useful. But it's not all that helpful for seeing deep dhammas. So the point is that don't stop the meditation and think, now I can do insight. Now I've got enough mindfulness to be able to contemplate Aditya Dukkha Anatta. Keep on going until that mindfulness is so strong. And I've given her a few standards for judging whether mindfulness is strong or not. Where you can look at even that red ribbon on the side there and see it's just the most brilliant red you've ever seen in the whole world. And just things just keep opening up in their beauty to you. That's the sort of power of mindfulness which is good enough to see dhammas. Has that stuff to happen? Yeah, you've got enough mindfulness to look at Aditya Dukkha Anatta or past lives. If you look at that carpet or that red thing, what the heck is Ajahn Brahm talking about? That means the mindfulness isn't strong enough yet. So we do this meditation retreat to, one of the things is to empower that mindfulness. And it happens to you. It happens to many people. And it's one of those lovely stages. Sometimes on meditation retreats, people want actually to have some idea of knowing how they're doing. Are they getting peaceful? Is this really what we're supposed to be doing? But it's also to see what it does to our senses. And when the senses become strong like that, then you know that something's happening. And it's good. And don't be afraid or don't be surprised when these things happen to you. It's just the mind begins to become very, very strong. And there's somebody was saying the other day that they were looking at a water, it started to melt, started to disintegrate. That's what the heck's going on there. And it's just like the perception is becoming strong, start to see things in other ways. Our perception is so heavily conditioned. We've been taught to see in certain ways. And the idea of seeing a solid brick wall completely vanish into the void, start to wobble and shake and vibrate, start to melt just like liquid just falling down. And then nothing left afterwards. You think, my goodness, I'm going crazy. It's not. People in the world say that's craziness. It's just perception. You're being allowed to take wing and to do things it's not usually allowed to do. And that's great fun. A little bit of weirdness in meditation is great. Life is so boring out there in the world. Any weirdness you have to go and watch the television for. But you know, it's a good meditation. You don't need television. Just watch a wall. Wow, look at that. Much better special effects than Steven Spielberg can do. So, all these things that you're doing, but, you know, they surprise and shock you. I mean, one of the first times this started happening to me was in Thailand when I was going past the washing line. And there was this white cloth. It actually wasn't white, it was black. Jet black. I looked upon that and said, what's a monk doing with a black cloth on the line? I looked at it for a while, then it turned white again. What's going on with my senses? And 1 minute the cloth was jet black. Now, not just for a flash, but for quite a while. And then it was actually brilliant white. And what was my senses doing? And then later on, you read in the suttas that sometimes the Buddha could, during the night time, see it as daytime. During the daytime, see it as night. See the beautiful in the ugly. See the ugly in the beautiful. Just perception playing around. And when you're not afraid of that, because you've got good teachers to say, oh, that's just perception, just playing around, enjoy it, have fun. And it is fun. You see all sorts of weird things happen. So this is now where I say you can see a person just as teeth. Or you see them just as bones is more likely. Or you see them just as like a rotting corpse, just in front of you, just get old and just rot away. It's just perception, just doing its thing. Say, oh, this is interesting. You don't get scared because you know it's just part of the course. You see that perception thing, you know, the beauty in just an ordinary carpet. Just perception is just being able to do things it's not normally allowed to do. As a child, you could do that. Some of you. But you were taught out of it. You were trained out of it. You're not supposed to do that. You said at school, your parents. So you forgot how to do it. And all of our perception goes according to our social norms. In meditation, those norms are taken away. And the perception has wings. You go to all sorts of weird things. But nothing is dangerous at all. As long as you know, it's just perception, that's all. It's no big deal. It's just fun. Okay. Oh, I've gone over again. So, it's 9 o'clock now. Now's the time for interview times.